Some crimes are so shocking, they don't just make headlines, they forever change our society. I'm Katie Ring, host of America's Most Infamous Crimes. Each week, I take on one of the most notorious criminal cases. Each case unfolds across multiple episodes, released every Tuesday through Thursday, from the first sign that something was wrong to the moment the truth came out or didn't. Listen to and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is a true crime in real time update featuring reports from Odyssey radio stations across the country. We're bringing you updates on developing investigations, deep dives into cases, and more. This week, we're taking a look at cases that bring up questions about the signs leading up to crimes. Are there ways for us to predict when a perpetrator will strike? Ways to prevent crimes from happening? Are we doing enough to make sure that perpetrators won't strike again? In this episode, you'll hear from KNX News' The LA Local podcast about a man who was arrested for starting the massive Pacific Palisades fire that claimed 12 lives while also ruining homes, businesses, and more. You'll also hear from a crime expert in New Orleans about a carjacker with a frightening past, and from the legal team of a woman who claims she was sexually abused by a nurse in Michigan of that nurse's alleged history of assault. But first, we'll check in with KRLD in Dallas about the latest update in the case of a toddler who was stabbed to death 4 years ago.
4-year-old Cash Guerin was sleeping in his crib when he was kidnapped and stabbed to death. His body was found about 8 blocks from his home in southwest Dallas. Police say it was 22-year-old Darian Brown who did it and even had security footage showing the kidnapping. Brown's defense team says he had recently been released from a mental health facility and was in a trance-like state at the time of the murder. As jury selection was about to begin, Brown pleaded guilty to a murder charge. Cash Guerin's mom spoke to Brown during victim impact statements.
There are no words to describe the pain that you have brought onto our family. I hate you with every part of my being. You murdered our little boy, stabbing him over and over again, and left him lying on the street like he was garbage.
Brown was immediately sentenced to life in prison, but does have the possibility of parole.
As the Pacific Palisades fire, the most destructive fire in Los Angeles history, ripped through homes earlier this year, it wasn't clear exactly what started the blaze, if it was an accident or if it was arson. The U.S. Department of Justice said this week that it was the latter. It announced that 29-year-old Florida man Jonathan Rindernecht has been charged with destruction of property by means of fire. Rindernecht was arrested Tuesday. Evidence cited by the Justice Department indicates that the young man maliciously lit this deadly fire. Here's the LA Local, hosted by Daniela DiRabbio, with more.
Law enforcement got to work and by January 24th had identified and interviewed the defendant. During his interview, he lied about where he was when he first saw the Lockman fire, claiming he was near the bottom of a hiking trail. Geolocation data for the 911 call showed that he was standing above the fire in a clearing merely 30 feet from the blaze as it rapidly grew.
U.S. Attorney Bill Asaley says Rindernecht, who used to live in the Palisades, was listening to a French rap song about fire as he watched crews put out the Lockman fire, which investigators say went underground and reignited as the Palisades fire. They even say Rindernecht's ChatGPT showed a dystopian painting of a burning forest and a crowd running from it. The ATF's Kitty Cooper says the evidence against Rindernecht is extensive.
We collected more than 13,000 items of evidence, including fire debris, digital data, DNA samples, all analyzed by ATF's state-of-the-art forensic lab. Our team carried out 500 scientific tests, supported by ATS Fire Research Lab.
Rindernecht is facing federal arson charges. The Palisades fire claimed 12 lives and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. In downtown LA, I'm Karen Adams.
After that press conference, we spoke with prosecutor and attorney Nima Romani. He told us this was an unusual investigation.
The fact that you have the experts that have tied him definitively through cell phone evidence, that's not something new. We see that a lot on the law enforcement side, right? Cell phone is really a treasure trove of evidence. It puts you at the scene. Obviously, his videos, ChatGPT is something we're seeing a lot right now. But the expert analysis by ATF and their fire investigators tying the January 7th to the 1st, that's not something that you typically see.
He also said that when this case goes to trial, the defense will have a tough time winning the case.
Lied to law enforcement. So now he's really put himself at the scene. It's going to be very hard for him to argue that he didn't start the fire, right? I mean, that's something his defense may do. They really got to try to break up that causation. That's really the only way to defend this case. And look, let's just be honest. This is one of the worst fires in California state history. He's going to be facing 12 men and women here in California. I don't think they're going to have a lot of sympathy for this guy. It's going to be very hard to find jurors that may buy any of these defense arguments.
Councilmember Tracy Park, who represents the Palisades area, got emotional as she spoke about the arrest. Here's what she had to say.
But I really want to begin today by remembering the 12 lives that were lost in the Palisades fire. 12 souls who will never come home, and 12 families who never got the chance to say, I love you, or goodbye. Their names are etched in our hearts, fathers, mothers, children, friends, all gone because of one unthinkable act. And while an arrest has finally been made, there is no justice equal to the pain that this community has endured. On January 7th and the days that followed, the world watched in disbelief and horror as the hills above the Pacific Ocean turned into an inferno. Flames devoured entire neighborhoods, moving faster than anyone could run. Thousands of families fled with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And maybe the faint hope that they'd have something left to come back to. But of course, as we learned on January 8th, that was not true for thousands of people. More than 5,800 homes gone. But they weren't just houses, they were living histories, places where birthdays were celebrated, babies took their first steps, and generations gathered around dinner tables. Within those walls were handwritten letters from grandparents, love letters to spouses, wedding albums, children's drawings taped to refrigerators, family heirlooms carried across oceans. All of it lost in hours because of one senseless act. As we learned earlier today, this wasn't an accident. The charges against the perpetrator demonstrate that it was a calculated, malicious act that unleashed death and destruction on innocent people. It was a crime against life, a crime against community, and against belonging. And we're not going to let an act of that magnitude fade into statistics. We're here to name it for what it is: arson.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Carl Morgan, a 36-year-old chef at longtime New Orleans dining destination Brennan's in the French Quarter, was waiting to pick up his son from daycare on September 30th. Later, he was found by police with gunshot wounds, and he became another victim of a fatal carjacking reported in the city. Raymond Wells, a 21-year-old, has been accused of Morgan's murder. According to reports, he had been neglecting to take medication for mental conditions at the time of the crime. Wells was eventually found in Morgan's vehicle with a gunshot wound to the head. He died last Friday after being put on life support. Rafael Goenecke, president of the New Orleans Metropolitan Crime Commission, joined WWL Radio's Newell Norman this week to discuss Wells' criminal history.
You've uncovered some really disturbing revelations about this individual and about, I guess it's safe to say, the failure of the criminal justice system as it relates to this suspect or individual, I should say. The trauma, the emotion around it, a young baby without his father, just the horrific nature just goes on and on.
Right. So the only good that can come from a tragedy like this is to figure out maybe how it happened and try and determine if the system could have done anything and learn from the mistakes that were made. And this is, a classic case of why it's so critically important for the criminal justice system post-arrest to do their job and make decisions, not just what they think is the compassionate thing to do in the context of the offender, but to also make decisions that are taking into consideration the threat that some of these repeat offenders pose to themselves and the community. And my review of the perpetrator of this murder's criminal history, my opinion is he should not have been on the streets to have committed, that carjacking and murder. So let me kind of go over the criminal history of Raymond Wells, who's now deceased. He took his own life, after the carjacking and murder. But in 2022, September of 2022, while he was a student in high school, he was captured on video beating up a school teacher. That's a felony under state law. So that was in September of 2022. And he was released from custody. And while he was free on bail for the battery on a school teacher, he was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon in July of 2023, which is a misdemeanor. So he got out of custody on that misdemeanor charge. And then in October of 23, he was arrested on a battery charge in municipal court, another misdemeanor. And then in February of 2024, he was arrested this time by the NOPD, carrying a concealed weapon with controlled dangerous substances, which is a second-class felony, meaning that there is a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So the police department arrested him on that. They determined that the firearm that he was carrying was a stolen weapon, so they booked him on possession of stolen property. They also discovered drugs on him, and the quantities of drugs suggested that he was possessing it with intent to distribute. And then he was carrying a concealed weapon, so he was booked with that. The DA's office accepted all of those charges. So the police are operating on probable cause. They submit their report to the DA's office. The DA's office reviews the police report and assesses whether there is sufficient evidence to convict the individual of the offense for which they're being charged with. So the screening division of the district attorney's office concluded that the police department appropriately arrested him for the 95E, which is illegal carrying of a weapon while in possession of controlled dangerous substances, and that offense alone is a mandatory minimum of 5 years. On top of that, the other charges meant that he could potentially be multiple billed as an habitual offender. But let me get to that in a moment. So the DA's office accepts all those charges. So those charges were accepted. And then the battery on a police officer, battery on a school teacher and battery and carrying a concealed weapon arrests from 2022 and 23 were concluded with guilty pleas some 4 months after his arrest on the guns and drug charges. So, in other words, he had been arrested for carrying a weapon with controlled dangerous substance, a mandatory minimum of 5 years, the drugs and the gun charges. And after he was arrested on that, he pled guilty to the battery on a school teacher and carrying a concealed weapon in June of 2024. He received 1 year suspended sentence and 1 year of inactive probation, which means that his probation was not supervised by a probation officer. He was ordered to enroll in CAFE Reconcile and an integrity program, and also seek some mental health and substance abuse treatments. So that was the disposition of the 2022 and 2023 offenses, with basically a slap on the wrist, inactive probation. Apparently, the court concluded that he had mental health and substance abuse issues, and they granted him inactive probation with no supervision, even after he had been arrested a few months earlier on new weapons and drug charges. So he's out on the streets, you know, after he has pled guilty in June of 24, the February of 24 arrest and prosecutions were concluded with another guilty plea in May of 2025, some 4 months before he murdered Mr. Morgan during the carjacking. So in May of 2025, Raymond Wells was allowed to plead guilty to a reduced charge. The DA's office gave him a reduction. Instead of having him and charging him as carrying a weapon while in possession of drugs, they reduced that weapons charge to a misdemeanor, meaning that instead of a mandatory minimum of 5 years, he was eligible for probation and a suspended sentence. But he still pled guilty to the drugs. So obviously the police department rightfully concluded that he was in possession of a firearm and drugs, which made it a mandatory minimum of 5 years. The DA's office accepted those charges, but in May of 2025, they allowed him to plead to a misdemeanor weapons charge and receive 2 years of suspended sentence and 2 years of active probation. That was 4 months before he committed the murder of Mr. Morgan during the carjacking. So the best predictor of the future is to look at the past. This is obviously a troubled individual that has a series of four arrests over a 2.5 year period of time, has not one, but two felony convictions, progressing from serious to more serious. He was probated the first time, he was probated the second time, and the third time resulted in, you know, the murder of, you know, a young father, and a son is not going to have their dad, and his wife is not going to have her husband anymore because of poor decisions that were made by the prosecution and the judge. So the judge did not have to sentence this individual to a suspended sentence. That wasn't a requirement. The judge had discretion. So the judge shares some blame, but the DA's office is supposed to be representing the people of Louisiana. And Mr. Wells had criminal defense counsel, and I think that this chain of events was set into motion because the district attorney's office made a miscalculation in assessing the threats that this individual posed to the community and to himself. So, you know, this is a tragedy. The only good that can come from this tragedy is to assess what went wrong and do everything in our power to prevent it from occurring again in the future. So nobody wants to lock up people that don't pose a risk to the public, but I would argue, based on this criminal history, that the leniency that the district attorney's office gave to Mr. Wells not only did not do him any favors, it ultimately cost, you know, a young man his life, and that family will never recover from this senseless tragedy that should not have occurred, in my opinion. I believe that he should have been in custody, and if he had been sentenced, he would not have been on the streets some 4 months after his May guilty plea to commit this crime.
A woman who was hospitalized at Detroit Medical Center, Sinai Grace Hospital, has sued the institution for $100 million over claims of sexual assault. Her suit alleges that ex-nurse Wilfredo Figueroa Barrios sexually assaulted her multiple times while she was a patient there. Now, more survivors of her alleged abuser are coming forward. Attorneys Todd Flood and Jim Harrington held a press conference about the case this week. Here are selected excerpts. Full audio is available through the WWJ News Radio On Demand feed.
It's an honor to sit in this or stand in this room with Mr. Harrington. This is a joint force to help survivors come forward against a predator and against an institution that allowed that predator to work in its confines. Quite candidly, the honor is mine to work with Jim and his team and the FIGER team, and that's why we're here today, to make sure that all the survivors out there know about our forces coming together. I will tell you this, we filed our lawsuit, the original lawsuit, against the institution of Sinai Grace and Tenet, along with the predator and others. And since that time, that time frame, you will see in the upcoming days the whistleblower, the nurse that blew this off the lid, if you will. She came forward, and we will be filing a lawsuit on her behalf as well. The questions remain, what did Tenet know? When did they know it? Well, you'll find out. There's seven more victims, seven more survivors, if you will, that have come forward to law enforcement. Those cases will be prosecuted. And you'll come to find out that the predator in this case worked at other hospitals. And this is what we're afraid of. He worked at Trinity Hospital out in Livonia. You're going to find out, and it'll come to the attention of all of us later on in the whistleblower lawsuit, that there were survivors there at Trinity as well. You'll come to find out as well, as we move forward in the second lawsuit for the whistleblower, that she was fired shortly after she told everyone. There'll be this report, it's called the MIDAS report, M-I-D-A-S. She made it mandatory to turn in this predator to the higher-ups. And when she did that, she was frowned upon, because what did they know and when did they know it? Well, they knew the defendant, the predator, was someone that had other complaints against him, and they wanted to sweep it under the rug. That is the tragedy of what's going on. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim. Jim, too, is taking on all the survivors with us, and I'm humbled to work with them. I'm humbled to work with the FIGER team. So Flood Law and the FIGER team, we're here to join forces to take on Goliath, if you will. That's what we do.
When a situation like this happens, when something like this happens, I think it rocks our community at the core. We look to these institutions, these hospitals, as places of trust, places of safety, places where we're very vulnerable, when we need help, when we're at our worst. When individuals like this predator, as Mr. Flood has said, and that I agree with, when individuals are not supervised, when they're brought into these institutions without having a proper background check, without doing just the simple work to determine whether or not this individual is fit, and they put this individual with vulnerable patients, with people who need help, with people who are on medications that painkillers or that affect their judgment, and they don't know what's going on, and allow this to flourish, it is something that has to be stopped. It is something that cannot continue, and it is something that Mr. Flood, our office, is telling the community right now that this will not go unchecked. We are going to look under every single stone, and we will put a stop to this so we never have to let this happen again in our community. Ms. Cooper is here. I give her, she has so much courage to come forward, to contact us, to help. It was simply too hard for her to come in here to face all of you. She is here today, and we ask for everybody really to pray for all of the survivors that are out there. You know, Mr. Flood and I have had a number of conversations. I've worked with him in the past. He's a phenomenal lawyer. His firm is excellent. And we're very, very, it's unfortunate, but we're very excited to be able to work together on this and help the clients that we represent, that he represents, and all of the other survivors that are out there that have yet to come forward. And we urge them to come forward because their voice matters, their voice is important, and their voice needs to be heard. The lawsuit was filed yesterday on behalf of LaShonda Cooper. We filed that yesterday in the Wayne County Circuit Court. The complaint contains 9 allegations of misconduct applying to both the predator in this case, as well as Sinai Grace Hospital and the parent corporations. We have not heard anything from the other side. We have not received any information about anything or who will be representing. We do anticipate that this will take time and that there will be information that we obtain that we will give to you. We hope that Sinai Grace will do the right thing and be transparent in their investigation and provide you with materials as well. But in my experience, and I've seen most of you here before, that usually rarely happens. And you'll get the information from me, but you can count on us to provide you with the information as this goes on, because I believe that this is a story. This is something that is very, very important, because this can never, ever happen again to any of our loved ones. The history of Mr. Berrios is absolutely alarming. Having been fired from other institutions for doing just this, having had assault charges before being hired at Sinai Grace. And as I said before, a simple background check would have revealed these incidents. And you know, somebody like this, somebody who is depraved enough to sexually assault, commit sexual violence on patients, doesn't wake up one day and say, hey, today's a good day that it's gonna start, right? This is something that develops over time, that supervisors who do their job, that administrators who do their job would see this. And it was there before they even let this man into that building with the body of previous complaints. So we hope and trust that Sinai Grace will do the right thing and maybe notify other survivors. I doubt they will. But we're here to hold them accountable, to give our clients their day in court, to give our clients their day to justice, and make sure that something like this never, ever happens again.
We want you to help and have as many of these survivors step forward. And it's also important that survivors step forward with law enforcement, because that's the other key. I've been lead counsel and handled many sexual assault cases in my time, and I echo Jim's sentiments. The electronically stored information is the breadcrumbs to a lot of different crimes that may have taken place in this case.
Can you guys at all speak to, as far as the victims and survivors that you have talked with already, was it the same MO in the Ms. Cooper case where claims were changing cabinet and touched her private parts? Was it the same MO with the other victims as far as you know?
Well, when you say MO, there is a lot of very similar identifiable themes, and you know, isolating and part of the grooming process before this happens, you have to identify what a predator does is they identify their prey, they isolate their prey, and they go in and abuse the prey. Okay, so in that context, in that situation, yeah, there was a very similar MO that was done with Ms. Cooper. It was the catheter. With other individuals, it was taking them into bathrooms and abusing, sexually abusing them there. So it wasn't just a catheter type of situation. It was the identify, isolate, and commit the act of sexual violence.
Yeah, no, we do have a profile. It is a profile, and law enforcement has built up this profile. You'll see it comes out, how he targets, who he targets, the vulnerability of the patients. So Jim's right. Most crimes don't happen in the middle of Ford Field. They happen behind closed doors. He profiled the victims ahead of time of who he wanted to go after, and he did it. So I see a similar MO, if you want to say modus operandi. You see that common scheme and plan.
What's up, little psychos? I'm Investigator Slater, host of the Psychopedia podcast. Psychopedia is a true crime podcast delivering raw, real, and absolutely gripping episodes every single week. I dig deep to uncover fascinating details of heinous true crime cases while exploring criminology and psychology theories. I take you into the absolute darkest corners of the human psyche, my favorite territory, and present cases like you've never heard them before. Follow and listen to Psychopedia everywhere you get your podcasts.
As for signs that Figueroa Barrios was a threat, the attorney said a simple social media search revealed quite a bit about the man's alleged intentions.
All you had to do was look at social media, right? And that's part of the background. Jim's going to hire somebody. He's going to go to background check. He's going to look at your social media. This guy was talking about how he wanted to have fun at a race for the cure of giving breast exams and how he wanted to take advantage of cancer survivors. Okay, that's on his social media page. Didn't take much.
On the Sinai Grace statement that they have rigorous policies of background check and rigorous policies to screen people. Of course they're going to say that, but did they follow it? They didn't say that in their statement. They didn't say, we followed our policies, we adhered to our policies. In fact, I'm confident that after discovery is through in this case, that they breached their policies, they violated their policies. And the social media post that Mr. Flood was talking about was on this race for the cure. So many boobs to take care of. It's a hard job, but someone's got to do it. Okay, that's somebody that you want treating vulnerable patients in your facility. That alone. But that doesn't even deal with the prior acts of misconduct that he was fired for at other hospitals. Okay, so what's absent from the Sinai Grace statement is that they complied with what they say are their vigorous and policies that they have on hiring. That's important.
It would shock the conscience if I told you what nurses said, other people of service said to Ms. Williams, who was in treatment at Sinai Grace. Things to the extent of, you're just trying to set him up, or if you were my wife, I'd kick you to the curb. This is right out of a movie, this FBI profiling. When you look at this predator, he had a dual life, and he tried to assuage the life of being someone that lives amongst us, but yet was a predator. And the key about it is the people that are trained, and I find this to be the most shocking, the people that are trained to protect us, nurses, doctors, they all go through this training of what to look for and how to identify people like this predator.
Thank you so much for listening to this roundup of true crime news from Odyssey. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. You can stay up to date on true crime stories with these weekly roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or Bitter Academia on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all, I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together, we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one. So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast.
Reality Gaze, let's love.